If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a monthly podcast alternating fortnightly with its stablemate, the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Paleo Cinema looks at movies more than 20 years old in a wide range of genres and tries to find the cool, obscure or forgotten cinema of the past and brings it to your attention. Feedback is important, so please leave reviews on iTunes, email feedback, either written or MP3 attachment, to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru with a K at gmail.com. Or if you are in the USA, you can leave voicemails on area code 206-203-3299. This podcast contains coarse language and adult concepts, so you know it's going to be good.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 110. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I am looking at the career of Rodney Sturt Taylor. Yep, Rod Taylor. Flavour of the month with podcasting community, but a good Sydney boy like myself. In fact, he was born about 10 kilometres away from where I was born, somewhat earlier. And I really do like him as an actor. He's had a fantastic career. I'll give you an idea of some of the directors he's worked with. Rod Taylor's worked with George Pell, George Stevens, Edmund Dmytryk, Delbert Mann, Alfred Hitchcock, Anthony Asquith, John Ford, Jack Cardiff, Gordon Douglas, Michelangelo Antonioni, and Quentin Tarantino. He's also worked with a number of really great actors. Let me just go through the name check a few of those. Montgomery Clift, Alan Ladd, Edward G. Robinson, Sterling Hayden, Ernest Borgnine, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, Burt Lancaster, Rita Hayworth, Deborah Carr, David Niven, Jane Fonda, James Dean, Betty Davis, Jim Brown, Orson Welles, Maggie Smith, Carl Malden, Michael Rennie, Christopher Plummer, John Wayne, Richard Harris and Michael Fassbender. So he's had an incredible career going from 1952 to 2009. And because I like him and because he's come up and also because there's a new documentary going to be coming out about him, I thought I'd do a special episode for the last one of 2012, just looking at the career of Rod Taylor and having a little bit of a discussion around why I think he's such a cool actor and why I think his movies are underappreciated among movie fans. So sit back and we're going to go on a bit of a ride. Hi, how is everybody? I'm here in the brand new man cave, which is a larger room in the house, and I've got all of the DVDs and Blu-rays in here, and there is a substantial number of them. It's about 2 days before the end of 2012 as I record this one, and I'm looking out at a clear blue sky. The weather's warm but not too hot, and if you're somewhere where you're snowbound, too bad for you. But anyway, well, nothing much been happening apart from the full Christmas catastrophe around here. We went and visited Sal's family for Christmas across town and ate inordinate amounts of food, caught up with people. Had a bit of fun and came back. Now, I didn't take any leave apart from the public holidays during the Christmas break, which in retrospect could well be a mistake because none of the decent cafes in town are open. So I go to work and there are no decent cafes open. They're having a break until January. So I'm quite sad about that. I've got to be able to find a decent coffee in town in order to pump myself full of energy and enthusiasm. By the way, I have seen a few movies, but Django Unchained hasn't started here yet. It's going to start on the 24th of January for reasons known best to movie distribution companies, which is a pisser because I do want to see that film. I'll just go through a little bit of a list on what I have been watching. I'll check a few high spots. Yesterday I watched The Return of the Magnificent Seven from 1966, which only has Yul Brynner back from the original cast, which is a little bit sad, but it was an okay Western. I've got the box set of the Blu-rays of the Magnificent Seven film, so I thought I'd check out the second one. And yeah, it's not too bad for a spaghetti Western. I did watch one of my favourite old Warner Brothers musicals from the 1940s, Thank You Lucky Stars, which has got everybody who was working for Warner Brothers at the time in it. It's got Ida Lupino, Betty Davis, Humphrey Bogart, Cuddle Seagal, Edward Everett Horton's in it, just everybody. Hattie McDaniels is in it. It's a terrific little musical. It was put together to raise funds for the Hollywood Canteen during the war, and I've got a fondness for it. It's got John Garfield singing, for instance, which is a bit crazy, so I watched that. Let's see, also rewatched for this podcast, in fact, Dark of the Sun, the Rod Taylor movie from 1968 with Jim Brown, Kenneth Moore, Yvette Mimieux, Andre Morella, and a number of other people. Chainsaw Fight, in that, as other people have said in other podcasts, is exceptional. I'll talk a little bit more about that later in this podcast. But I did have a lot of fun with that. I did see the Palm Beach Story, Preston Sturges' movie with Joel McRae and Claudette Colbert in it from the 1930s. And that too was a lot of fun. I won't do any spoilers on that, but if you haven't seen it, it's worth checking out. Let's see. I'm just going to go into the Mizo proper because I was actually using the Mizo link on the Paleo Cinema website for some reason. Let's just see if there's anything else of note. So I've kind of been taking it easy, not doing too much. Oh yeah, I did see Steven Soderbergh's Contagion from a year or so ago, and isn't that a feel-good holiday movie? Yeah, basically one-twelfth of the planet gets destroyed while this virus is rampaging around the place. Gwyneth Paltrow gets autopsied on screen. It's quite a fun film in that way. The other thing that I watched that was really impressive was Moonrise Kingdom. I do recommend that one. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's got Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Francis McDormand, Harvey Keitel, Tilda Swinton in it. And it's a little bit of fun. Basically, the story is a pair of young lovers flee their New England town, which causes the local search party to find out and find them. But it's got magic realism. It's got all those kinds of little quirks and weird bits and not entirely realistic kind of cinematography that you find in Wes Anderson movies. And yeah, I did enjoy it a lot. I found it quite sweet and charming and a little bit of fun. So if you haven't glommed that one, I think you should. Let me just see if there is anything else I've watched of note. Probably not. And I'm not going to bore you with trying to mumble my way through a memory lapse on that. I am watching the entire series of Babylon 5 again just because I want to. It's probably more Martian Drive-In related, and I may kind of bring that into a Martian Drive-In podcast, but I just wanted to veg out a little bit. This is my break in a sense too, because I don't have the radio gig for the next few weeks, so I'm kind of, I don't have that push to get out a podcast every fortnight and a radio movie watched every week. So I'm just chilling out a little bit and not feeling any pressure to watch movies that of, you know, certain movies. So that's, in a sense, breathing space for me and a little bit of fun. Let's have a look. What did I get for Christmas? Oh, yes, I got the James Bond Blu-ray box set for Christmas, which was quite impressive. And I'm giving away the Blu-rays of the James Bond films that I already had to friends. In fact, that's another thing I'm doing, which is quite interesting. As I acquire Blu-rays of various movies, I'm passing on the DVD copies that I had of them to other people. Maybe you want to consider this as a possibility if you are getting aboard the Blu-ray bandwagon. It really is nice to be able to go, okay, here's my copy of Fellini's 8.5. You should have this and watch this to people. And I'm doing that a little bit. And I'm finding it quite emotionally satisfying to do that. Again, it's like passing on information about movies in the podcasts, except I'm actually passing on the movies themselves. So that's quite, I find that inordinately pleasurable to just give movies away. I mean, I wish I could give a movie to everybody listening, but unfortunately I can't. I can only give tips on them. But that's probably my takeaway from 2012 is giving information about movies and movies themselves is one of the great pleasures that I have in life. And I want to continue doing so for a very long time. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to look at the early years of Rod Taylor. I'm going to break down this podcast into several sections. We're going to go early career, mid-career, and a big fame, later career, and then wrap it up at the end. We do have some feedback as well, which is going to be quite good. So I'm going to take a break, and then when I get back, we're going to look at the early years of Rod Taylor.
Bella Darby, Miracle the Ralston, Eddie Lamar, Delilah Judith, Deborah Carr, Dale Evans, Steve Reeves, Gia Scala, Cecil Hayakawa.
That was Rob McEwen with the Beverly Hills Telephone Directory. So, on to the early life of Rod Taylor. He was born in January 1930, which means he's coming up on his 83rd birthday, January 11th, in fact, in Sydney, as I said. He was the only son of William Taylor and Mona Stewart Taylor. His father was a construction contractor, steel construction contractor, and his mother wrote plays and children's books. Now, Rod Taylor's middle name, Sturt, is a pretty important name in Australian history. His great-great-granduncle was Charles Sturt, who was one of the great inland explorers of Australia. He went off, headed west from Sydney, and they had this idea at the time that there was an inland sea in Australia. There had to be a source of all these rivers that were flowing westward over the ranges. And they went looking for the inland sea. They didn't find one because there isn't one. But they did find the Murray River system and the Darling River as well. And Rod Taylor's ancestor, Charles Sturt, was Very much a part of that. Now, he found it with the first person to go the entire length of the longest river in Australia, the Murray, and he found the Darling River by travelling northwest out of Sydney, across the ranges and across the plains to that. So his family's been in Australia for a very long time. He attended Parramatta High School and graduated at the age of 14, so he left school at 14 and went to the East Sydney Technical and Fine Arts College. Now, the reason he did that was his mother wanted him to be an artist. His father did a little bit of extra work in the 1930s as a draftsman, and Rod would sit there with his father and draw things while his father was doing the draftsmanship. 1930s, of course, being the middle of the Depression, and times were tough, so he took whatever work you can get. As a teenager, you know, he was an artist to start with. He was very active in, he was a boxer, an amateur boxer, and he was also a member of a surf life-saving club out on the beaches in Sydney. So grew up very athletic, and of course, you know, the athletic look that we know Rod Taylor from his classic films to have. And one of the things that really got him to be an actor was Laurence Olivier came to Australia and did Shakespeare in Australia in the late 1940s. He brought Vivian Leigh, his wife, and they did a number of things, and Rod Taylor attended a couple of performances and really got the acting bug from that. Now, the interesting thing about that is one of the Australian actors that was working with Olivier and Leigh at the time was Peter Finch, who had an affair with Vivian Leigh. So there's a little bit of a crossover there between two major Australian actors, Peter Finch and Rod Taylor, though they never worked together, and they may have known each other. They don't have any evidence one way or the other, but they would have known of each other quite well. So he started out in acting, and the way to be an actor in Australia at the time, he did. I found a little bit of evidence that he did some performances of Shakespeare. In fact, he did Julius Caesar in a theatre in North Sydney in 1950. Along with John Millian, who people right remember from movies like On the Beach and They're a Weird Mob. He's one of the major characters in They're a Weird Mob. And later on, in the 1970s, went on to do The Picture Show Man with Rod Taylor. They'd known each other since 1950 and were jobbing actors together. So it would have been a great performance to see, actually. So he was doing that, but his big gig was on radio. In fact, he was the voice of Tarzan on Australian radio. They used to do radio serials. The scripts would come over from America for the radio serials America had. So you'd get like an Australian version of Superman radio serials and an Australian version of Tarzan. And Rod Taylor was the voice of Tarzan in Australian radio in the very early 1950s. So he made a good living. At the time, it was a good living. Being a major radio actor. Before television didn't come in Australia until 1956, so radio stayed big longer than it did in perhaps the UK or the US. So he was still doing a little bit of artwork at the time too. He worked as a commercial artist for a time, working for Mark Foy's store in Sydney. And all his life he's painted too. And if you go to Rod Taylor's website, and I'll put a link up on the show notes, you'll see some of his watercolours. And they're quite good watercolours. They're not necessarily going to give Van Gogh or Monet any challenges, but they're good, honest works, and they're quite interesting. And I don't think anybody would be ashamed to hang them on the walls. So he's always had that kind of dual stream of being an actor and an artist, which is kind of rare. It's a really unusual thing for an Australian actor too. At the time, there was very much a kind of blokey guy culture in Australia, and art and artists were seen as somewhat effeminate at the time. So to have this big strapping boxer and surf lifesaver actor who was also an artist in there, kind of, and of course was very, very interested in women, was quite unusual at the time, let's say. But you know, Rod did it, and all his life he's had that love of art. By the way, the performance he saw Olivier in was Richard III, which was quite interesting as well. So here he is, he's at the age of 20, early 20s, 20, 21, 22. He's a jobbing actor in Australia. He's still doing some artwork. He's very much famous in the Australian radio circles for being the voice of Tarzan and things like that. And, of course, with radio, you can't see a person's age, so you can play many different kinds of roles if you've got a versatile voice. So his first film was actually a short documentary about Charles Sturt, where he played one of the crewmen. There was a little bit of a documentary film crew that went out to film the story of Charles Sturt. I think that they were the kind of things that were shown in school auditoria as a part of a history class. So he did a little bit of work in that. And then along came Chips Rafferty. Now, Chips Rafferty had been famous for about a decade or more as the Australian actor. He was in 40,000 Horsemen. He was in The Desert Rats as well. He did Eureka Stockade, The Overlanders, a number of films in early career. And he was a big, big advocate for an Australian film industry. Now, at this time, Australian films hadn't really been going anywhere for about 15 years, since about the mid-1930s. In the 1920s and in the teens, Australia had as big a film industry as Hollywood, but it deteriorated because of a lot of shady deals that were done between American film studios and state and federal governments in Australia in the 1920s and 1930s. So Rod hooked up with Chips Rafferty to make a film. Well, Chips Rafferty was actually working with Charles Tingwell, Bud Tingwell, a very famous Australian actor who only died a couple of years ago. He was one of the characters in any number of Australian films. So he had a very long, distinguished career. And in fact, appeared in a Hammer Frankenstein movie as well. If you look for Charles Tingwell, he was in one of those. So they decided they were going to make a film in the Torres Strait Islands called King of the Coral Sea. And Chips Rafferty and Charles Tingwell found this jobbing actor in Sydney called Rod Taylor to play one of the characters in the film Jack Gennaro. I've got a copy of King of the Coral Sea and haven't watched it all yet, but there's some good location shooting on it. And while some of the secondary roles act very amateurishly, it was a very successful film. It was sold to the States. It did very well in Australia too. They promoted it pretty well all through the country Australia, particularly up in Queensland. And Rod Taylor got his career start playing Jack Gennaro. He was wearing a pencil mustache at the time and quite brawny. But he had that charisma that we know Rod Taylor to have, and that, of course, saw him well. He went on to make another film that was made in Australia with Robert Newton. Robert Newton, people know from playing Lon John Silver in Treasure Island. He was in Odd Man Out, for instance, with James Mason. I've mentioned that in a podcast before. So they made Long John Silver in Sydney with Robert Newton. In fact, you can see the whole film on YouTube if you want to have a go at that. And one of the weird things was that Rod Taylor played a very old character in the film. They wanted somebody to play an old guy. He made himself up and played an aged character in this quite low-budget version of Long John Silver, a sequel to Treasure Island. And the weird thing was that the people in Hollywood who saw the film, of course, Robert Newton was known in Hollywood as well, wanted this old guy to come to Hollywood and screen test for some old character roles. They'd done the same thing with Cecil Kellaway, another Australian actor, about 20 years before. So what happened was, they go, yeah, we want the old guy out of Long John Silver. He's got something, you know, we want to see him. And the producers of the film go, well, the guy's 22, and they'll send him anyway. So Rod Taylor went to the US, and his career took off over the rest of the 1950s. He was in a number of films. He did Helen Frisco Bay with Alan Ladd in 1955. He did a science fiction film, World Without End, in 1956. And then did some work for MGM. He became a contract player with MGM and did Giant, Rain Tree County, which it's a film I really like, even though it's flawed and it was interrupted by a very severe car accident that Montgomery Clift had during the production of the film. I do like Rain Tree County. He did Separate Tables with Burt Lancaster and Rita Hayworth and a bunch of other people, David Niven in it, and things like that. So he was a jobbing actor throughout the 1950s in some quite prestigious productions. You know, he was learning his craft, he was learning film work and cinema in the 1950s. And then 1960 came along and he got a gig doing a TV show called Hong Kong. He was the right kind of person for that kind of role. It's one of those kind of exotic adventure TV series that were very popular in the late 50s and early 1960s. And Rod Taylor, yeah, athletic guy, could speak well, not bad in a punch-up, so he could do some of his own stunts. So he was the perfect actor for this kind of role. And he indeed played that role for one season.
Hong Kong, the last foothold of freedom on the vast mainland of China. Here in this city of anxious millions, the fate of Asia hangs by a thread. And some say the world's as well. My job here as an American news correspondent is to keep that picture clear. To work with our British friends to keep this lighthouse of liberty shining. But the truth must also be aided by actions, and often I find myself in the fight. In strange ways that begin where least expected. Even among friends of an innocent evening. Well, as innocent as Navy men ever can be around very attractive girls.
Yep, Rod Taylor was the most well-paid actor in a one-hour show in America at the time. He was paid $3,500 an episode to do Hong Kong. And so it was quite successful. Very successful here in Australia because he was one of ours and the TV series was imported over and became successful and was played well into the mid-1960s on repeats here in Australian television, which is where I first saw it. And a number of episodes are up on YouTube. The quality is not fantastic, but it's very watchable. And it's good to see some of Rod's early work in that. Now, 1960 was also his first starring role in the film too, and that one is the one that I think is really the linchpin to the career of Rod Taylor. It's the one that we all know from our childhoods, it's the one that we really like most, and it's the one magical film of the 1960s that I really can go back to repeatedly and really get more out of each time. Yep, we're talking about The Time Machine from 1960 with Alan Young, Yvette Mimieux, Sebastian Cabot, and, of course, Rod Taylor. And I've talked about this in podcasts before. It's one of my favourite science fiction films. I think it's one of the best science fiction adventure films of all time. It's incredibly accessible. You can show it to children. In fact, I'm going to send my nephew Billy, who's about 2.5 now, a copy of The Time Machine just so he can enjoy it when he gets a little tiny bit older, because I think it's just one of those great adventures. It teaches a lot of lessons as well. The friendship between the character Philby and the time traveller, the sense of wonder about the film and the sense of adventure and the sense of fun that it has is immeasurable. And I was thinking about this a little earlier this afternoon over a cup of coffee. And I can't think of another actor who could do this role in exactly the same way or as well as Rod Taylor could. There were any number of good English actors at the time, and continue to be, of course, to this day. But you've got to have that combination of the philosopher scientist and the man of action for that film. And I think Rod Taylor portrays both sides of the character really, really well. It's fun to watch just for his acting. I mean, the stop motion, of course, is dated, but I think that the film is just immensely treasurable. I really feel like it. The Guy Pearce remake, of course, in 2002, has a lot more flaws to it, and I think it was done mostly because the state-of-the-art of digital camera trickery increased to the point where you could show the time travelling in a much more interesting way. In fact, that film is probably best seen just for the time travel scenes, or you could splice them into the Rod Taylor one, I don't know. But one way or the other, the Rod Taylor one is incredible. And it does show his odd combination of that thoughtfulness and the artist in the man, as well as the man of action. You know, this is a guy who in his young years was an artist, a boxer, and a surf lifesaver at the same time. And I think that Rod Taylor, in a number of his roles, shows that dichotomy between the man of action and the artist in subtle ways. It's not always obvious in all films. Not all of his films have this, but there are some that have that nice combination, which I really like. And The Time Machine is, not arguably at all, my favourite Rod Taylor film for that reason.
As I went along, I gained experience in handling the machine. I found that I could stop for a day, an hour, or even for a second to observe. Then go ahead a year or two. Thus, I was able to see the changing world in a series of glimpses.
Because the time machine at the time it was made was immensely popular, and it was of great benefit to Rod Taylor's career. Over the next few years, he did some interesting films. I think The Time Machine may have been a slow burn in some ways, because there are a couple of films he did subsequent to this that maybe are of lesser value than some of the ones he did before and after this. He did a Peplum movie called Colossus and the Amazon Queen in 1960. Maybe this is... It was released about a month after The Time Machine, so maybe he did it before The Time Machine, but it was released after it. And then he did the voice for Disney's 101 Dalmatians, which, it's a jobbing acting role, and you can't really tell it's Rod Taylor, but Rod Taylor's charm comes through a little bit in 101 Dalmatians. I haven't seen it for a long time, but I do remember being impressed by the fact that an Australian actor was in it. And then he did an interesting little piece with another expatriate Australian actor, Keith Michelle, as an Italian movie about Francis Drake and Queen Elizabeth I, called Seven Seas to Calais. It occasionally turns up on channels here in Australia like TCM, and you can find it out on the Inca webs if you know where to look. It's a little bit of fun. It has a number of Italian actors in it as well, so it's a little bit of an odd bird. And speaking of odd birds, in 1963, along with Tippi Hedren, Rod Taylor did make The Birds with Alfred Hitchcock. Now, I rewatched The Birds recently, and to be honest with you, it's not the best Rod Taylor movie out there. It's not even the best Alfred Hitchcock movie out there. The matte lines make themselves apparent. I think there's a little too much manipulation of the audience in the film to make it one of Hitchcock's best. But, you know, Rod did the gig well, playing the charming stranger, and really still maintaining that action role actor kind of charm about him. But the best movie he did in 1963 that I like, and it does turn up on Australian television at times, is Sunday in New York, where it's a romantic comedy with Jane Fonda, Cliff Roberts and Robert Culp in it. And it's got a great jazz score by Peter Nero as well. I played a little bit of it at the start of the podcast. And I think there's a great chemistry between Jane Fonda and Rod Taylor in this film. It's just a kind of light piece of early 1966 comedy fluff. But given that, it's got an interesting cast. It's a little bit of fun. It's kind of cool. And it's got two very charismatic stars, basically. I was going to say antagonists, but they're not antagonists. They start out antagonistic in a certain extent, but then romance happens and all that kind of thing. Rod Taylor and Jane Fonda really should have done more comedies together, as far as I can see.
Look, I'm sorry. I hope you weren't offended by my note. It seemed the only sensible thing to do.
By your note?
Yeah, the waiter did give you a note, didn't he? I hope you got it.
No, I didn't.
Well, look, I assure you, I just didn't get up and leave. I left a note explaining why.
I see. Excuse me.
No, but wait a minute. Well, look, wait a minute. I wouldn't just get up and leave. Look, I swear I wrote you a note. I'd like to go back to the waiter and prove it.
What did you say in your note?
Well, I was conscious of the fact that you weren't too pleased with either me or my efforts to entertain you, so I... Well, I wasn't wrong, was I?
No.
Well, so I thought the most practical and least painful solution was to kind of disappear, so I put approximately that in the note, and besides, I was... What's the matter?
Well, to tell you the truth, I wrote you a note.
What?
I didn't come back to the table either.
No.
Yes.
Well, what did you put in your note?
About the same thing you put in yours.
No.
Yes.
In fact, 1963 was a pretty gangbuster year for Rod Taylor. He had four movies released in the year, and all of them are more or less interesting stuff. Of course, we've got Sunday, New York, and The Birds. We know about those two. But there was another movie called The VIPs, which had an immense amount of publicity surrounding it because it starred Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, who had become mega famous as a couple because of the scandal of their liaison during the making of Cleopatra, which was released around the same time. It's a kind of portmanteau film about rich people at an airport, and the airport's fogged in, and there are dramas involved. It's got a great little turn by Margaret Rutherford playing the Duchess of Brighton, a dotty old lady. It's got Louis Jourdan playing Elizabeth Taylor's lover, and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton are a married couple who are estranged. It's got Orson Welles playing a movie producer, very much larger than life. It's got people in it like Ronald Fraser and Dennis Price. And it's got a really nice turn by Rod Taylor playing, for a change, an Australian magnate called Les Mangrum, who's trying to get a deal through and is having some problems with its shares and things like that. And he is really good in it. He kind of livens it up, the stolid romance between Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor takes up a lot of the time, and it sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the air. But something about Rod Taylor in the film really lifts it for me, at least. And he's playing against his secretary, Miss Mead, played by a young and very attractive Maggie Smith. And their rapport, just like the rapport with Jane Fonda in Sunday in New York, is very, very good. The characters have a chemistry, and there's a kind of evolving romance between them, which I found really interesting and touching. They were, working with Maggie Smith seemed to bring out the best in Rod Taylor as an actor. They worked again a little bit later in another film, Young Cassidy, which I'll talk about in a sec. But they really did hit it off, and I watched that movie and then fast forward to the bits that have Rod Taylor in them, just for the fact that they're really interesting. Of course, I'll pause a little bit for Margaret Rutherford and Orson Welles and people like that, but the Burton and Taylor romance kind of tragedy kind of thing in the film does drag it down a little bit. But again, that's one that turns up on TCM fairly frequently, and it's a little bit of fun to watch. In the same year, he also did a movie called A Gathering of Eagles with Rod Taylor, working for Delbert Mann, a director he'd worked for before. And it's basically Rock Hudson plays an Air Force colonel who's just been assigned to a Cold War B-52 commander and must shape up, been reassigned as a Cold War B-52 commander who must shape up his men to pass a grueling inspection that his previous commander had failed and had been fired for. So basically it's aeroplanes, but a kind of soap opera-y plot. It's one of those movies that's probably well worth forgetting because it didn't do very well. It gets a 6.1 on IMDb, and it's not one of Rod Taylor's best films. But there were a couple of really good ones coming up in the next few years that I like a lot. First one being Fate is the Hunter, with Glenn Ford, Nancy Kwan, and Rod Taylor. And he plays a pilot of a crashed airline and has a few good bits and pieces in there. And it's a very nice little mystery film about how did the plane crash, what caused it to crash, and that kind of thing. And Glenn Ford plays an investigator who looks into this. It's got other people in it. An interesting cast, actually. Suzanne Plachette's in it. Jane Russell plays herself in it. Wally Cox is in it. Constance Towers, who people remember from The Naked Kiss, is in it. Howard St. John. Mary Wicks is in it as well, which is kind of cool. I'm going to have to revisit that one, I think, because the cast alone makes it worth the price of admission. And in 1965, he did a really, really cool film based on a story by Roald Dahl, in fact, called 36 Hours. And the story in this one is James Gunn is the protagonist and Rod Taylor plays the bad guy, sort of. An American major wakes up after falling unconscious just before D-Day and is told that it's 10 years later he suffered from amnesia and the war's over. And he's in a rehabilitation center in Germany. Things don't turn out to be true. That doesn't turn out to be true, but it's a good, honest little action thriller. It was filmed in black and white. I think it should have been filmed in color, but I think they might have gone on the cheap by filming it in black and white. But it's got a good cast. James Garner, Eva Marie Saint, Rod Taylor, Werner Peters, who's been in any number of German crimi films, Alan Napier, who played Alfred the Butler in the TV series Batman, Celia Lovsky, who was Peter Lorre's wife, and a bunch of other actors. But that's a really nice little thriller if you get a chance to see it, directed by George Seaton, and Rod Taylor playing the German pretending to be an American and trying to convince James Garner that it is 10 years after the war. He's really good too. He's kind of conflicted and a more complex character than Rod Taylor had played for a while. And he does an exceptionally good job of it. Next film he did was actually directed by two people. Jack Cardiff is ostensibly the director, but it was also directed by John Ford, who left the film because of illness, and that's Young Cassidy. Basically, it's a biographical drama celebrating the early life of playwright Sean O'Casey. And, of course, Rod Taylor plays O'Casey in it. It's got, a terrific cast. And it's a film that's worth seeing. Let's see. Julie Christie's in it. Maggie Smith, of course. Michael Redgrave, Edith Evans, Flora Robeson, Sean Phillips, who was the wife of Peter O'Toole for a long time, T.P. McKenna. And it was filmed on location in Ireland, and it's worth checking out to see Rod Taylor in a more complex character role. Really, even though he wasn't a particularly young man at the time, he was 35, playing a man in his early 20s, but I think he made it work, and this is another one of those films that turns up on TCM a fair bit. And it does show that Rod Taylor had a fair bit of range as an actor. Now, I'm going to take a break now, and then we're going to get into the later 60s and a number of the action films, and then, of course, the TV career of Rod Taylor. But I'll take a break, and when I get back, we'll get into that.
These men are mercenaries. Brave. Brutal. The best in the business. War is their profession. Danger is their specialty. $50 million in diamonds is their mission. Danger is their 9-to-5 job. And there's nothing more dangerous than diamonds.
The diamonds, where are they? Where are they?
Don't, Dewey, don't kill him.
Kill him, I'm going to cut Hanline's head off.
Dangerous, aren't you?
I came down out of the trees by invitation, and I will kill anybody who tries to send me back up again.
Violence in the tempting beauty of a woman.
Where were you? We waited for you. We waited for you.
Violence in guns and bare hands of hired heroes. Strike force of crack mercenaries fights the hottest battles in all the blazing hell of today's strife-torn Congo. Dark of the Sun.
Dark of the Sun is one of the great action films of the 1960s, no question asked. GGTMC did it recently in their crossover episode with the Feminine Critique podcast. And, yeah, it's a fantastic action film directed by Jack Cardiff. It's got Rod Taylor and Jim Brown. Kenneth Moore's in it as well, Yvette Mimieux. And filmed in Jamaica, it's a fantastic action film. There's some crazy stunt work in there. There's a fight with a chainsaw, which has got to be seen to be believed. And it's got an incredibly nuanced ending, which is interesting as well. The action sequences are great. You're not going to see anything like them anywhere else. And if you haven't seen it, no, I think most people listening to this podcast already have, but if you haven't, it is a fucking tough action film. And Rod Taylor plays a mercenary, which could be seen in another actor's hands perhaps as a two-dimensional character, but he does give it nuance. And he and Jim Brown, I think, make a pretty good team in the film as well. There's a big bromance happening there, and it's one of my favorite of his films, basically because it is an incredibly violent action film, but there's it's got a little bit to say as well. There's some intelligence to the film, which I appreciate, which often doesn't happen. Now, you did this one coming off a few other films, which are quite interesting as well. I don't like the two films he did with Doris Day, The Glass Bottom Boat and Do Not Disturb. I think that they're really among the weakest stuff that he did. Not because of Rod Taylor himself, but I think the Doris Day 45-year-old virgin kind of act in movies really didn't play well in the middle of the swinging 60s. I think they were kind of 1950s films filmed about 10 years too late. And you know, Rod does pretty well in them, but I don't think that they're among his best work. He also did Chucker, which is an interesting small western, which has got Ernest Borgnine and John Mills in it. You should see that one. It's around the place. It's available, and I recommend it. He was pretty good at westerns. I'll give him that as well. And he did another movie, which Vince from over at the B-Moviecasts gave me a copy of, called Hotel, which is one of those great big portmanteau movies like Grand Hotel was in the 1930s. We get a whole bunch of different actors in. Carl Malden's in it, Camilla Sparves playing the love interest in it, Michael Rennie's in it, Merle Oberon, a bunch of other people. And there's some nice bits with Carmen McRae, the jazz singer, and Peter McDermott, the character played by Rod Taylor. He plays the manager of a large hotel which is being threatened by being owned by a conglomerate. Melvin Douglas plays the guy who owns the hotel. And I kind of like it because I think it shows that range that Rod Taylor had as an actor. He plays an intelligent bachelor who's running a hotel, balancing a whole bunch of people. He's a diplomat at times. He's tough when it needs to be, but it's a little, again, it shows more nuance than a lot of other actors would have played the role in. And I do have a fondness for it. I think it's a very classy film as well. So on the back of that and Dark of the Sun, which is also known in some parts of the world as The Mercenaries, he did a couple of movies, Hell with Heroes, which is a standard kind of action film. And then there's a movie that kind of possibly knocked his career in the ass, and that was Antonioni's Zabriskie Point, which is basically a poisoned Valentine to America as it was at the time. It was a time of great turmoil, the Vietnam War, pollution, right-wing conspiracies, Richard Nixon, fascism, the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago all got rolled into this Italian movie director's big-budget film about America and why he doesn't like it. And I don't know how he got MGM to bankroll the film. And this stars two people, Dario Halperin and Mark Frechette, who hadn't acted before and didn't do too much else. I think Mark Frechette died in jail, for instance. But it's an interesting movie. Great soundtrack. Fantastic bands at the time in the soundtrack. Rod Taylor playing a kind of businessman who's having an affair with the Dario Halperin character. But because of the film, which is not well regarded among most people, was so hateful of America, it kind of did derail his career a little bit, which is a shame because I think there's a lot of qualities to the Rod Taylor as an actor that don't get appreciated as much as they should have. And Zabriskie points one of the excuses used to justify that, in a sense. He then went and worked in Europe a little bit. I've got to mention a mid-60s movie he did, which is a kind of weird little off-the-track piece for his career. Of course, that's The Liquidator, which was a James Bond pastiche Rod Taylor started in the mid-1960s, based on a novel by John Gardner, who went on to write James Bond novels in the 70s and 80s. He plays a character called Boyesy Oakes, who is mistaken for somebody who's a stone killer and gets recruited by Trevor Howard, running an intelligence agency, to basically be his assassin. The conceit there, of course, is he's actually a coward and hates violence, and gets an assassin to do the work for him, played quite drolly by the English comic actor Eric Sykes. It's not a bad little film. It's kind of a standard 60s James Bond pastiche. It falls into the Euro spy kind of genre. It's got Jill St. John in it as well, which is never a bad thing. But it's quite lightweight stuff, and it just kind of shows the playful and silly side of Rod Taylor as an actor. So we're getting up towards 1970, and there's still a couple of good films left in Rod Taylor's career. The one I really have the most fondness for, even though he wasn't exactly right for the role he's playing, and excuse me while my chair squeaks, is 1970's Darker Than Amber, directed by Robert Klaus, who went on to direct Enter the Dragon a couple of years later. It's based on the John D. McDonald Travis McGee novel of the same name, and I've kind of liked the Travis McGee novel since I first discovered them in a library in the 1970s. In fact, I've got all of them. I've got a lot of John D. McDonald's novels. And he plays Travis McGee, who's a kind of salvage consultant. He goes and finds things that have been stolen or are missing for people and keeps half of the money for himself as a reward on it. And McGee's a kind of complex character. He's a kind of faded knight errant. And he gets involved in this case with a woman who's thrown off a bridge. He's in a boat under the bridge with his best friend Maya. She gets thrown off a bridge with some weights tied around her ankles, and he tries to find out what happens and why that occurred. The movie varies from the book in a couple of significant ways. There's no romantic love interest between him and between Travis McGee and the Vanjie character, played in this film by Susie Kendall, who looks stunning. In the book, there's no romance between them, but in the movie there is. And I think Rod Taylor is quite good. He can play a kind of thoughtful character quite well, and there's a brutal action scene in this film between him and William Smith, the great character heavy actor, which is one of the great biffs in movie history. It really is brutal, and in fact in a lot of prints it was cut because of that violence. It follows the plot of the book quite closely, given that one exception with the romantic love interest thing. And Theodore Bakel's in it playing Meyer, and he's very good in the role. James Booth, another English actor who is a friend of Rod Taylor's, has a small role in it. A number of other people. Anna Capri, who later on went to work in Enter the Dragon, plays one of the females in the film. And it's really, I think, not perfect, but I don't dislike it as a John D. McDonald adaptation. And I think Rod's pretty good in it, even though physically he's not quite right for the character. It was played again in the late 70s, early 80s by Sam Elliott, who's physically right for the character. Apart from the pussy brush mustache that he had at the time. So we've got that film. There are a couple of other ones. He did The Train Robbers and an interesting little film he did in London called The Man Who Had Power Over Women, where he plays a record executive, which I kind of like because it's one of the few films that you see a character killed by a truck full of toilets falling off on top of him. That character being played by James Booth. There are other films, Trader Horn, a few action films like Trader Horn, The Deadly Trackers in 1973. And then it skips to a small action film called Jamaican Gold in 77. And he went back to Australia in 1977 as well to do The Picture Show Man, which was an Australian film starring John Millian and John Hewitt as a couple of guys who had a travelling cinema. Back in the silent era, there were travelling cinemas around Australia where they'd be on the back of a truck, they'd set up a tent, show movies to people for places that didn't have cinemas in small outback communities. And Rod Taylor comes along as a kind of an American entrepreneur who represents in the film the transition to America dominating the Australian film industry. There were a lot of films like that that were about that change over time in history. There's this one. There's a very good film about newsreel cameramen called Newsfront that Philip Noyce did in the late 1970s, early 1980s again, which is worth checking out. So there's that one. Picture Show Man was quite popular in Australia, and Rod was welcomed back to Australia really strongly at the time because people do have a lot of fondness for him as an actor here in Australia. And I keep saying as an actor, I'm sorry about that. He then went on to do a lot of stuff on TV. There's one other film I haven't mentioned which I really do kind of like. The High Commissioner from 1968. I've forgotten that one. Again, this is one of the rare roles where he played an Australian. He plays a Sydney detective called Scobie Malone who's sent to London to arrest the Australian High Commissioner in London for the murder of his wife many years ago. And he gets involved with terrorists. He gets involved with beautiful women. And it's a good, solid little action film. And it also stars Christopher Plummer playing an Australian, so they've got a Canadian actor playing an Australian in the film. And I haven't seen it in a number of years. I'm going to have to pick up a copy of The High Commissioner, which there's got another name. I think Nobody Lives Forever or something like that. Just give me a moment, I'll find the name of it. Again, a lot of films have multiple titles. The High Commissioner, 1968, directed by Ralph Thomas, an English director. Let's see, the other name, it's based on an Australian novel by a guy called John Cleary as well. It was released as, let's have a look here, Nobody Runs Forever is what it was called. And Lily Palmer's in it, Camilla Sparve again, Dahlia Lavi, Clive Revel, Calvin Lockhart, Darren Nesbitt, Burke Kwok's in it, Franchot Tone's in it as well, in one of his last roles. So that one's, I'm going to, when I finish doing this monumentally long podcast, monumentally long from my point of view because I've done a lot more homework for it than I have previous ones, I think I'm going to have to track down a copy of The High Commissioner and watch it. I normally have a comfort film after I do a podcast, and I think that's going to be my comfort film this time around because I do like it. There was a second Scobie Malone movie done as a kind of sleazy 1970s comedy, playing up the sexual aspect of the character and making him into a bit of a playboy with Jack Thompson playing Scobie Malone, and that movie's called Helga's Web, where it's about somebody finding a woman's body in the Sydney Opera House, and Scobie Malone, the police detective, sent out to investigate it as well. It's very much an late 70s, early 1980s Australian film, which means there are a lot of tits in it. So, leaving that aside, getting back to Rod Taylor, he did a lot of television. I remember there was a couple of TV series I liked him in back in the day. There were Bearcats with Dennis Cole. They played a couple of kind of soldiers of fortune who travel around the West in a Stutz Bearcat around just after the beginning of the 20th century, blowing things up and shooting things and in general causing sufficient amount of mayhem. In 83 and 84, he did a spy series called Masquerade with a young Kirstie Alley and Greg Evigan in it. Basically, it's a kind of Mission Impossible kind of thing. He played a character called Mr. Lavender. It only went for 13 episodes, but I kind of liked it because he got to wear a tuxedo and be very cool, and he out-acted everybody else on the screen in that one. There was another film, one of the few science fiction films that Rod Taylor did, called Outlaws in 1986 and 1987, where a bunch of cowboys are sent forward through time from 1886 to 1986 and end up fighting crime. There are 11 episodes of that. Richard Roundtree was in it. Charles Napier was in it as well, so that's kind of cool. It didn't last for very long, but it was good to see Rod back in the saddle again with a gun in his hand. His career kind of petered out a little bit until, I'd say, around 1997, when he played Daddy-O in a weird Australian film called Welcome to Whoop Whoop, which a lot of people hate, but I've got a kind of fondness for it. It's a weird combination of a Mad Max movie and a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. It's about an American con man who gets roped into living in a remote outback community, which is totally off the grid, ruled over by a patriarch called Big Daddy from the local pub. And Big Daddy goes around in football shirt and shorts, I'm going to have to slow down a little bit. And he has a number of great scenes in that. He has a party trick where he has some tap dancing shoes hooked up to a car battery and tap dances on the bar of the pub, causing electrical sparks to shoot everywhere. And he has a lot of fun. It's a kind of broad role. It's a comedy role, and he has a lot of fun in it as well. And most of his dialogue seems to consist of him saying "fuck me dead" to people. But I kind of like it. I think it's a weird and wonderful little piece. It's not a great film, but it's a quirky enough film to keep my interest. I did a TV movie called The Osiris Chronicles in 1998. The only real things he's done in there, if you discount crap like Walker, Texas Ranger, a movie called Core, which is a low-budget horror movie about crows attacking people, which had Stephen McHattie and Sean Patrick Flannery in it. And he has a little bit of a role. I think he got the role mostly because there are killer birds in it, and, of course, him being in birds. And then, of course, he got a phone call, and here's how that went.
I always admired Quentin, and I was here with a couple of Aussie journalists who had just come from interviewing Quentin. And they said, Tarantino really digs you. And I said, forget it. About 4 or 5 months later, he calls, no agent, no casting director, nothing like that. He calls my business manager's office. I want to talk to Rod. And so I got the message and I said, what's the number? So I called saying, which one of my drunken friends is, you know, doing it this early in the morning? He comes out of a casting meeting, and it is Quentin Tarantino. We start talking like a couple of old women for at least an hour about his movies, my movies, our movies, somebody else's movies, 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 like we've known each other for 20 years. And finally I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm making a movie about World War II. I thought, well, okay, yeah. And he said, well, not really World War II. It's kind of a, it's a World War II. I said, okay, what do you want me to do for you? I'll do anything. And I very nearly retracted that. But he said, I want you to play Winston Churchill. I said, you're shooting in Germany? He said, yeah. Does that matter? And I said, well, you're right across the channel from England, and there's Albert Finney. He's done Churchill about 6 times. And he said, if Rod Taylor turns me down, I'll call Albert Finney. Well, there's your friend for life. I would have done anything for him.
And there you go. That brings us up to date in Glorious Bastards with Rod Taylor playing Winston Churchill. And all through the first time I saw Inglourious Basterds, I had a smile on my face when I was watching that scene with Michael Fassbender and Rod Taylor. And Yeah, it's a nice way to cap off a career. He hasn't done anything in the last 3 or 4 years, and I don't know whether he is going to do anything further. But I've got a lot of admiration for Rod Taylor as an actor. He came from a not entirely dissimilar background to me. And, so much of my life, the movies I've watched have been Rod Taylor movies, and that's possibly one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about him in the podcast. Let's look at the roles he did. Straight up action film actor in things like Dark of the Sun. Full bore macho. He could have come off the cover of a 1960s men's action story magazine in that film. Sophisticated comedies like Sunday in New York, he could do those as well. He played a southern gentleman in Raintree County. He played an English lord in an English knight in Giant in his early career. He played a sailor in King of the Coral Sea. He played Francis Drake in Seven Seas to Calais. He played any number of Western characters. He played Travis McGee, one of the iconic crime novel characters of all time. He's played Australians, he's played Americans, he's played British characters as well. He stood toe-to-toe with the best actors of his time, people like Montgomery Clift. He had a number of scenes with Montgomery Clift, and he holds his own against them as against him. He was in the Portmanteau film, The VIPs, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton when they were at their peak, and he blew them off the screen. Really, the man is someone deserving of respect as an actor. He's done a wide range of roles, and more wider range than a lot of modern actors. You're not going to see Christian Bale doing a romantic comedy, for instance, and I've said this before in a podcast, Christian Bale should lighten the fuck up. But Rod really is somebody I admire as an actor. He's in my top 10 favourite actors of all time. And a good Australian lad makes good, and that's never a bad thing. I can get parochial about these things at times, and I do apologise for that. But all up, Rod Taylor, any of his films I find watchable. Some I like a lot more than others, but any movie or any TV show he's in is made more watchable by his inclusion, and there's not a lot of actors you can say that about, really. There are quirky actors like Christopher Walken, and others you can say that about, and Robert Mitchum's never been bad in a film, and I think Rod Taylor's right up there. And the weird thing is that he was talking about how there are a lot of pretty boy actors before he came in, people like Tyrone Power and Errol Flynn, and even Marlon Brando in his early days, who were beautiful actors. He said he was the first of the uglies to come in and have a movie career, but I don't think so. I think Rod Taylor's got... He's not an ugly man. Now, even in his old age, he has racked up a number of birthdays, and he hasn't had any work done, so he does look his age. But I think what he brought to the cinema was a masculinity nuanced by intelligence and by emotion. And I think that that's where he comes from. You look at Rod Taylor in any role that he ever did, and there's more than the role demands in what he does. And I think that's one of the things that likes him. He plays tough man characters, but they're tough characters that really are more than just tough. And I like him a lot, and I'm going to be... he is 83 now, and eventually, of course, he is going to die, and when he does, I'm going to be very sad, because I think we lost a true original when that happens. But I would like to see him in at least one or two more movies before that occurs. If it doesn't happen, I'll live with it. I've got a lot of movies of his to watch. But Rod Taylor, definite one-off, and definitely one of the great movie actors as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to take another break now. I want to get back. We've got feedback from the masses.
When you've got nothing and you want everything, you've got to get to be the Mac.
I mean, being rich and black means something, man. Don't you know that?
The Mac. His business is pleasure. He sells the soft stuff.
They're going to have to rewrite the Mac and Game book, baby, you know, because I'm going to be the new king.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the big moment we've all been waiting for. The Mac of the year, Goldie! Goldie! Goldie!
Brother's going to work it out.
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 Max Julian is Goldie, and Goldie is the Mac. The Mac, with Richard Pryor and music by Willie Hutch. The Mac, from Cinerama Releasing, rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent. Now that you've seen all the rest, make way for the Mac. The biggest and the best.
Okay, time for the feedback. First one I got is from Richard Palmer. He sent that through the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. And he says, Terry, I'm glad to hear you discuss The Fountainhead. I remember enjoying the movie mainly for Patricia Neal. The last speech by Gary Cooper at Rourke's trial is brutal. It turns into a lecture, and it's so long it gets to be mildly persuasive. It goes from being mildly persuasive to annoying. Haven't read the book or seen the movie in a while, but I wanted to add your discussion about the adaptation from the book. In the book, there isn't any question that Rourke's architectural designs are better than all the others. I don't remember anything about balconies in the book. Balconies are, as you pointed out, have a function. In the book, I recall the company of architects commissioned to finish a particular building recognized the genius of Rourke's designs, but they also point to decades of design that includes things like scrolls and leaves carved into columns. They try to bend Rourke to the accepted standards of beauty. They insist on tacking on ornamental flourishes to Rourke's designs and explain how it isn't that great a compromise. Rourke does not agree that beauty in his designs is what we might call ergonomic today. I believe that Rourke is based mainly on Frank Lloyd Wright. Wright was a big proponent of form follows function. Also, Wright wasn't the most humble manner. Imagine that if you encountered him in a successful part of his career, as Rand did, he might boast that he wouldn't compromise his designs, his creativity, or his intellectual property. Rich Palmer from the Rockcast. Yeah, thanks for that, Rich. The weird thing about this film is it's so didactic. It really is. And I'm getting a copies of now of the Atlas Shrugged movies, the two Atlas Shrugged movies, which I don't expect to be any good, but I want to watch just off the back of having done The Fountainhead. But I've got to agree that it's a dog's breakfast of a film, but it's not uninteresting. And that's one of the things. Sometimes it's not the good films that grab us at times. It's the really funky and weird shit. And that one definitely applies. So I do have some other feedback as well. I'll get on to the voicemails in a bit, but I'll get the other stuff. I got one from Stephen G. Wilson. He says, just started listening to Paleo Cinema and I'm really enjoying it. Watched Tulane Blacktop off the back of the Warren Oates episode. I'm looking forward to Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. I was wondering if you thought about reviewing Across 110th Street. It seems like a paleo sort of film. Yeah. I've done it for the radio. I did it for the ABC radio gig, as I said to you on Facebook as well. Stephen, but yeah, basically Across 110th Street, I will do it for Paleo Cinema, but for myself, I want to space out when I talk about the films on the radio to doing them on the podcast. At some stage, I'm going to try to get the audio from the Across 110th Street discussion I'd had with Ivor, and I'll post it as an additional Paleo Cinema podcast the way I've done with a couple of other ones in the past. But yeah, I like it a lot. I think Anthony Quinn's great in it. I think that Tony Franciosa's great in it. Yaphet Kotto's good in it as well. It's just one of those melting pot films of the time. And it does give you that great sense of Harlem as a community, as a place. And also the bad guys, the people who'd cause do the robbery, it's still from the mafia that causes all the fuss in the film, are nuanced characters, apart from Antonio Fargas, who's just basically out for the money and the pussy. The other characters in it are really nuanced. It's a great film. If you haven't seen Across 110th Street or haven't seen it in a while, good film. Really solid Bobby Womack soundtrack as well. But I'm going to save anything else I'm going to say about that until after I do it, because I'm getting in the mood again for doing a few blaxploitation kind of films of the era. And I think near the top of the list would be Across 110th Street. And it's a good recommendation, Stephen, so thanks very much for that. It reminds me of how much fun I had doing it on the radio. It was a joy to do. And Ivor enjoyed the film as well. He hadn't seen it since the 1970s, the same as me. And we both found it refreshing and great to see again. That's one of the lovely things. There are movies you've seen before, but if you revisit them, you can just get an incredibly rich experience from doing so, particularly if you haven't seen it in a decade or two.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita. Now, I'm not going to wish you a Merry Christmas because I know you don't really celebrate it. So I'm going to wish you, a Happy or Merry Newton-Moss. I know that's what you celebrate or have in the past. Or I could just say Happy December 25th. How about that? Just wanted to wish you a happy late December winter solstice season. And got to tell you, I'm a bit behind on the episodes. I think I've got two episodes of the Martian Drive-In podcast to listen to. And I think I've got maybe one episode of Paleo Cinema to listen to. You know, December, I do get into all the Christmas movies and holiday viewing and all that stuff. So I enjoy that. You know, I know that's not your cup of tea, but I enjoy it. And I'm about ready to get out of it. You know, I'm calling you here. It's about noon on the 24th. My day is done. So with that, I've got dogs barking in the background. I just want to wish you a happy season. Take care, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks for that, Richard, and thanks for all your support this year as well. You've been one of the great voicemail people of 2012 for me. Yeah, I mean, I've had a good time this season and got my DVD box set of James Bond films, so I'm quite pleased with that, even though I did get the Roger Moore ones as well. And the weather's been fairly mild for Christmas for us. In fact, it's not been as hot as it normally is, though that will probably change in January and February, but at the moment it's quite balmy, and our garden is going well, and thank you for that. I believe you've sent a second voicemail message not too long after the first one, so we'll get on to that as well.
Terry, this is Richard from Wichita again. I totally forgot it. The dogs in the background totally threw me off in the holiday message that I just left you. I wanted to ask and see if you had a chance to catch a movie called Hitchcock. I think it's something you might be interested in. It's on limited release here in the States, so most places aren't carrying it. I happened to catch it on Saturday afternoon, and I believe today, the 24th, is its last day before it leaves and makes way for the, you know, big rush of new Christmas movies coming out tomorrow. But it's an interesting film. It's got, that's the Anthony Hopkins film in which he stars as Alfred Hitchcock. It really centers on Hitchcock's relationship with his wife and the making of the movie Psycho. It's not a perfect film. Hopkins does a real good job at times of being Hitchcock. Other times he's coming off too much like Anthony Hopkins, kind of doing his usual shtick that he does in his film. So it kind of fluctuates back and forth. However, it is a really good kind of behind-the-scenes peek at the making of Psycho. And from what I understand, it's fairly accurate. I thought the actor they had playing Anthony Perkins was really good. And some people have said that Scarlett Johansson didn't do a good job as Janet Leigh. I think she kind of did at times. Again, I think it kind of depended on the scene, how good she was and how much she was in the role. Sometimes it seemed like she was really into it. Other times, again, it was kind of like we were watching Scarlett Johansson. So, but it's a worthwhile flick to catch. It's a good primer for me because I'm planning on watching a lot of Hitchcock films next year. I always have an overly ambitious list of movies to watch each year. And so I'm keeping it simple, and I'm keeping them very, an interesting contrast to films. I love the monster flicks, right? You know that. And so I want to finish up the Godzilla series. I'm in the early 70s right now, and I figured, you know, I'm going to go full steam ahead and finish up the Godzilla series of films. I've also got the about halfway through the Gamera films, so I want to finish that up, as well as I've got a stack of some miscellaneous Japanese sci-fi horror flicks. So I really want to concentrate on that this year, or I should say next year, 2013. But I've also really want to concentrate on the Hitchcock films. I've made a few recent purchases of some of his harder-to-find films. A couple of them I got on VHS. One of them called Under Capricorn was just recently on Turner Classic Movies. So I just want to dive into the Hitchcock films. I started them a couple years ago watching the early Hitchcock movies. Those are a little rough, and they are kind of hard to kind of dive into. But once you get past some of those earlier films in the 1930s, is when he really kind of starts to kick it into gear, about the late 1930s. And so I'm looking forward to doing that in 2013. So just kind of want your thoughts. I think you've talked about Hitchcock in the past, but kind of wondered what your thoughts were on Hitchcock, kind of what your favorite films were, maybe your least favorite, and whether or not you've had a chance to see the movie called Hitchcock. Okay, now I will leave you. I hope that you have a good holiday season. Take care, and looking forward to great stuff coming up in 2013. I'll be doing some catch-up over the holiday season here, listening to some podcasts that I've been sitting on for the last month or so, and I'm looking forward to some new stuff next year. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Again, thanks, Richard. Hitchcock, haven't seen it because it hasn't been released here yet, kind of like Django Unchained, but I do want to see it. I do like Hopkins. I do like Helen Mirren, so I think the combination of the two should be a bit of fun. That's a real problem with a film like this because we know what Hitchcock looks like. You've got Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You've got him doing the intros to all of the trailers for his films. He's an incredibly well-known character, so it's a hard ask for an actor to do it. I suppose you've got the same problem with Janet Leigh and Anthony Perkins and people playing that. They're not going to be the same. It's like anybody in any movie that plays Ava Gardner. They're never going to be like Ava Gardner. They're never going to have that hotness that Ava Gardner had, which is a big hurdle for a biographical film like this to overcome. I will see it at some stage, and when I do, I will mention it on Paleo Cinema. Made a little note of that already. But I do want to see it, and I do want... You know, I will offer the feedback on it. Now, as far as Godzilla and other kaiju movies, I'm looking forward to Pacific Rim. I think it's going to be a bit of a kaiju fans' feast day and a little bit of fun coming out. And I think Guillermo del Toro has got his finger on the pulse as far as cult cinema is concerned. So I think he's not going to piss it away. So I'm looking forward to that one. But I have got a bunch of Godzilla movies. I've got all the way back to the original Gojira. But, I'll revisit them at some stage. But, like, you know how it is. There's so much to see and so little time and only two eyeballs to do it all with. But I will recommend something for you, though, Richard. If you can get the book that Truffaut did interviewing Alfred Hitchcock, I've actually got it here. It's called Hitchcock by Truffaut, The Definitive Study. Mine's about 20, 25 years old, but it may be worth you scrounging around on eBay, see if you can find a copy of that, because it's two great film directors just discussing the career of Hitchcock, and as a resource while you're going through that phase of watching the Hitchcock films, it's probably going to be very valuable to you if you can find a copy of it. So on to the last bit of feedback now.
Paleo Cinema. Hey, man, this is Dr. Zahn, baby. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, dear. Now, hey, Paleo Cinema. Long time no see. We're here. Dr. Zahn, I'm calling in. It's about 4:17 a.m. in the a.m. America time. Haven't left any feedback in a little bit, and I thought I would give you a call because I've been kind of going on a little bit of an Orson Welles fest. I guess it would be a fest if I've watched like about three of his movies in the past, week. I watched Compulsion, and I watched The Lady from Shanghai, and I watched a little movie called, let me scroll down here and find it, because the name, it escapes me. It's escaping me. The Roots of Heaven, which was directed by John Huston, starred Trevor Howard and Errol Flynn, and Orson Welles is in there. I was just curious, because you are the master of disaster, the tower of power, the man of the hour, too sweet to be sour, baby. Terry Frost, the Frost Giant. I was wondering if you have any favorite Orson Welles movie, and if you have seen The Roots of Heaven, Compulsion, or The Lady from Shanghai, and if you have just a quick, mention or a quick little thing, blurb, whatever you want to do, blurb, about each one of those, and if you liked them or not, or whatever. Because I have my shirt off and I'm looking at my big, fat, hairy belly, I kind of am on an Orson Welles thing. All right, man.
if I don't get a chance to chat. Was it Nikola Tesla Day or I can't exactly remember Galileo. What holidays you godless heathens practice? But I think if I put Tesla or Galileo in a pagan Saint Nick outfit, I can still get the holiday spirit. Anyway, this is Dr. Zahn. I just wanted to say hi to you and yours and wish you a happy, happy holidays. Zahnout.
Hey, Zom, and I'm recording this on your birthday, so I'm going to make a public happy birthday to you. I hope you get everything you need and most of the things you want, and I hope you get laid. So have a good one, mate. Yeah, awesome, Wells. Yes, I have seen Compulsion with Bradford Dillman and Dean Stockwell playing Leopold and Loeb, and they've got that great speech with Orson Welles playing the Clarence Darrow-type character. And it's great. Just watch the speech if you don't want to watch the rest of the film. It's great, and it's one of the great pieces of oratory on film that Welles did. And I like him in it. I like Clarence Darrow, too. If you go online, you can find the original speech during the Leopold and Loeb court case that Clarence Darrow made. And they're not dissimilar, but they're not the same. But I like Clarence Darrow's one a little bit better. I think it's a great speech. It's one of the great humanist speeches of the 20th century, Clarence Darrow's summation for the Leopold and Loeb case. So I recommend that film as well. Lady from Shanghai, a classic, fantastic film noir, terrific acting. Everett Sloan was fucking mind-blowingly good in that film as well. I recommend that one highly. And the other one you mentioned was Roots of Heaven. Yeah, I saw that about a year ago. Julia Greco in it. It's all set in Africa. John Huston, of course, being the great white hunter in there. I recommend that one too. I think it's a good, solid piece of cinema. Errol Flynn was good in it. Flynn was good in his later years in a couple of roles. Sun Also Rises, things like that. But, I recommend all three. Favourite Welles films? You can't get past Citizen Kane. I just picked it up on Blu-ray, so I'm going to have to actually play the Blu-ray of that soon. I picked it up for an incredibly ridiculous price, which is always an added bonus for those sorts of things. I like that. I like Touch of Evil, which is one of my favourite Welles. It's got Marlene Dietrich in it as well, which is never a downside. There are a number of them. I kind of like The Stranger. You can find The Stranger. It's in public domain, where he plays an ex-Nazi who's monstering Loretta Young. I do like him in that one as well. F for Fake, of course, if you're looking in this sort of mockumentary kind of thing with Welles in it. I've got that on Blu-ray. I'm pretty sure I have. But, and basically, again, anything Welles had more than just a check-cashing role in is always a great piece of cinema. And just the voice itself is pretty good. So, yeah, and have a good new year yourself too, mate, and I hope to hear from you again, and I hope that Silver and Gold, your podcast with Piccolo, goes from strength to strength as well. That's about it. I've done 1 hour and 30 minutes so far almost, which is not bad, but I knew I'd go long with the Rod Taylor one. So I'm just going to name check a number of podcasts, and I've got a new one to add to the deal as well, so just give me a moment. I've got a Facebook message from Tony Bora, who does the 76th Street podcast, so I'll give that one a go if you like. Of course, The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, The Feminine Critique, Hammickus podcast. Let's have a look here. I'm going to have to write this list down. I'm just too disorganized for words. That's much better. I've got my list up now. The Writer and the Critic, Silver and Gold, of course. Shooting the Pooh podcast, 1951 Down Place with Brother D. Manny's other one, Mail Order Zombie. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, as I said. B-Movie Cast with Vince, Mary and Nick and the Mob. That's all good too. And I've already mentioned Hammickus. And everybody else who's out there, Action Attraction with Metal Mikey. Haven't listened to that one in a while. I do apologise, Mikey, but I'm in there. And check out all of the blogs as well. with the usual suspects. You can probably find links to it if you go to the Silver and Gold Facebook page, if you can get an invitation to that, or else the GGTMC Facebook page. They'd be the two places to really find out a whole bunch of this stuff. So that's about it. My throat is starting to giving out, which means I've done a long podcast. No, it wasn't at all about Cheney. So look after yourselves. I'm going to go try to track down a copy of The High Commissioner with Rod Taylor in it and a couple of other films that I like, and I'm going to take a break. I'll be back in 2 weeks with Martian Drive-In podcast. There's a possibility I'm getting Nick Sauer on to talk about Buckaroo Banzai and maybe some Babylon 5 as well on that one. That's still up in the air, but we're going to see what we can do about that. I'll be back in 4 weeks with another Paleo Cinema. Not sure what that's going to be about, but I'm pretty sure it's not Rod Taylor. And look after yourselves. Have a great new year. Play it safe out there, whether it's hot or cold where you are. Enjoy yourself. Have a drink for me. I've just got myself a little shot glass of Frangelico liqueur here that I'm going to enjoy once I finish talking. And take care of yourselves, and I'll be back again really soon. Bye.
Watch out, mister. Here comes the twister.
This is Rudy Ray Moore.
Yes, I'm the human tornado. I chain down thunder and handcuff lightning. I'm so damn strong, it's sometimes frightening. I grabbed a star traveling a million miles a minute and slowed it down to the state speed limit. Yes, I'm the human tornado. Spinning, grinning, and sinning. I used an earthquake to mix my milkshake. I eat an avalanche when I want ice cream. I punched a hurricane and made it a breeze. I swallowed an iceberg and didn't freeze. The human tornado. Flinging cash and talking trash. Beamy, delayed, relayed, mislaid, and parlayed. Jump, stomp, bumped, and mugwump. The human tornado. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without a parent or a note from your jailer.